This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Our last speaker of the day is our honored speaker for the annual Shriver Lecture and Award. Every year we offer this honor in we call it the Shriver Award to honor Eunice Shriver, who is part of the Kennedy Foundation, the Kennedy family, who advocated for community-based services and supports for people with developmental disabilities, and who started the Special Olympics, and her legacy of advocacy for our community and lives on. And we seek to honor somebody who has had a career where they have also made a tremendous difference for this community in their work over the course of many years. And so this year, the honor goes to Dr. Paul Glassman, who is Associate Dean for Research and Community Engagement at the College of Dental Medicine at the California North State University in Elk Grove, California. He's Professor Emeritus at the University of the Pacific and the School of Dentistry, and he has served on many national panels, including the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Oral Health Access to Services, which produced the IOM report on improving access to oral health care for the vulnerable and underserved populations. He currently serves as the chair of the California Department of Public Health Office of Oral Health's California Partnership for Oral Health. He had for many years a dental practice with experience treating patients with complex conditions, and has published and lectured extensively in the area of hospital dentistry, dentistry for patients with special needs, dentistry for individuals with medical disabilities, dentistry for patients with dental fear, geriatric dentistry, and oral health systems reform. He has a long career working with special populations in a variety of practice and community settings. He has been the principal investigator or co-principal investigator on over $35 million in grants and contracts devoted to community service demonstration and research programs designed to improve oral health for people with disabilities and other underserved populations. He's a pioneer that's led the national movement to improve oral health care using telehealth-connected teams and virtual dental homes. And finally, he's been prominent in advocacy efforts on state and national levels for the health system reform to improve oral health systems for a wide variety of underserved groups. And I want to express my personal thanks to you, Dr. Glassman, for your work in developing the RDHDP, the Registered Dental Hygienist Advanced Practice Program, which sends dental hygienists who have advanced training into homes and group homes to provide dental care to people who might not be able to receive that care in dental clinics, which are very overstimulating for many, the lights, the sounds, the other people. And in my own family, that program has enabled my daughter to maintain her dental health when before we were not able to do so through the system, even with very expert dentists. So you've made a difference for our community, and you've made a difference for me. And I want to thank you, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing your comments today.
Great. No, thank you so much, Dr. Crickfield. Of course, it's a great honor to be here and to be selected for this award. I really appreciate it. You know, I was looking back at my history with this conference, and I have spoken at it several times. The first time I spoke was in 2007, so that's almost 20 years ago. Time flies when you're having fun, I guess, but a lot of time has gone by. But as you said, I've been involved with working on dental care for people with developmental disabilities for much of my career. And again, a real honor to be able to be here. So, in talking about dental care, of course, there's lots of things that I could talk about, but for the purpose of the amount of time I have today, I decided that the thing that would probably be the most important to talk about is some work that we're specifically doing around keeping people from having dental care in the hospital operating room. So let me go ahead and share some slides now, and we'll kind of walk through a slide deck, and then I think we'll have a little time for some questions and answers and conversation afterwards. So you can see the title of this talk is Shortening the Line for Sedation and General Anesthesia for People with Disabilities. I'll talk a little bit more about what that means, shortening the line, in a few moments. In terms of disclosures, I don't have any. I'm involved in a consultation for lots of groups and organizations. Some products I may mention today, I don't get paid for my consultation, but that's just my disclosure. I want to just jump back to, again, looking at the sort of past history. Back to 2008, we did a survey of people in California who were having, this is for dental providers, and we're asking, looking at the various ways that people could have dental care. That was sort of followed by a publication that we did with a national group called the American Association of Special Needs Dentistry. And what we found was that there were few dental dentists willing to provide services for people with disabilities. It wasn't economically feasible. It took too much time. Hospitals were reluctant to give enough operating room time. We actually had developed a consensus statement, which was published in 2009 about these same issues. And looking at all the various ways that dental care could be provided, from anesthesia to sedation to behavior support, physical, psychological, the consensus was that most of the things at the bottom part of this list were not being used, because they weren't really paid for very well, people weren't trained, there wasn't enough awareness about that, there wasn't much policy that supported these kind of things. So what happens often is that someone with a developmental disability who has some kind of often behavioral or communication challenges goes into a dental office. The dentist may try a few things, but soon comes the conclusion, I can't really work on this person, and they get told they need dental care under general anesthesia. And they get in these horrible long waiting lines. There's the shorten the line concept, where people are waiting in California 1, 2, 3, sometimes 4 years to get their care. And of course, dental disease doesn't get any better during all that time. So it's really a pretty horrible, horrible problem. I want to spend just a couple of minutes talking about some developments in the world of dentistry that have taken place over the last several decades that have allowed us to really think differently about how we provide oral health for people in general, and then specifically for people with developmental disabilities. So really, I'll spend a few minutes on each of these three things. So one is something that's now being referred to as minimally invasive dentistry. Minimally invasive, traditionally meaning being able to do things using more medical management without needing surgical interventions and drilling and local anesthetic injections. So there's just a whole bunch of stuff in our toolkit that we didn't used to have. These are things that we refer to as remineralization and buffering agents and caries arresting medications and techniques for sealing caries and using other kinds of medical management. Some of you may have be familiar with things like fluoride varnish, which can remineralize teeth as the enamel begins to break down. Once there's a hole in the tooth, this stuff called silver-diamine fluoride, one drop of this in the cavity can actually stop the progression of decay. Not permanently, but every 6 months or so needs to be redone. Dental sealants have been around for a long time, but we didn't used to think that you could put them on top of an area where there's decay in the tooth. But now we know you can with modern materials. They actually seal in the bacteria. Bacteria are not getting nutrition from the saliva and basically starve the bacteria to death. And now we can actually repair small holes in teeth with no drilling and no anesthesia with a technique called interim therapeutic restorations that a dental hygienist can do. And you were mentioning the dental hygienists with the RDHAP degree. These can be done by them in a not out in a dental office. Doesn't require drilling, doesn't require anesthetic. And for many people, that's all they need. So we have the ability to keep a lot of people healthy now in community settings that we didn't used to. Plus, the criteria for what we do is changing. When I was in dental school, these couple, if you see the couple of dark spots on these teeth here, you would be reaching for the dental drill. Now it's actually malpractice to do that. These are areas, what we call demineralization, where that can be repaired, does not require surgical intervention. So vastly different ways of dealing with dental disease than we used to have in the past. Another change that's taken place in the world in dentistry, at least the part of the world in dentistry that I live in, is something called community-engaged dental care systems. And this is a change in the focus of dental care. I think in the dental care system, and it's probably true in general health care as well, the main focus of dental care is things that happen in a physician's or a dentist's office. Most people think about dental care, you dial the phone, you go make an appointment with a dentist, and that's where it happens. Well, now we know, and I'll give you an example in a minute, that it's actually possible to completely change the focus, to change the focus of dental care to community settings, basically bringing care to people where people are. Many people can be kept healthy in community settings. I'm actually at a conference today, so sort of multitasking that we're talking earlier about with 150 people from schools around the state. We can keep about 85% of children healthy at school without needing to set foot in a dental office. And so just one example of that kind of community-based system where the idea is keep people healthy in the community, minimize the number of trips. The dental office is a complicated, expensive, advanced surgical place that general dental care for most people doesn't need to take place there. So we've developed this idea we call a virtual dental home, really quite a while ago, more than almost 20 years ago. The title of virtual dental home comes along with the idea of the medical home originally, and then the health home. In dentistry, it's interesting that most people in the dental world think of the dental home as the physical bricks and mortar dental office. That's not the way the term health home necessarily is thought of in general healthcare. It's much more thought of as a series of systems and supports to help people get what they need when they need it. But in the world of dental care, it's often thought about as the physical office. Well, so that's why we use the word virtual dental home. We're providing all the services you'd expect in that kind of environment, but it's in a distributed environment, various people connected together through a telehealth system. So an example of how that works, this is a dental hygienist and an assistant with portable equipment. They can be in one place one day, another place another day. They can collect all the stuff you'd expect to have in a fully electronic dental record system, including x-rays now with digital x-ray equipment. This is photographs. You can see the little picture of the tooth in the background there. You are able to collect a full set of dental records, the same set you expect to see in a dental office where they were using fully electronic records. All that stuff can be made available to a dentist who's not on site using cloud-based electronic record systems. The dentist can actually complete a full and completely appropriate dental examination. And then the team, RDHAB hygienists and assistants, can actually do a lot of things in the community environment. Community environment could be someone's house, it could be a school, it could be all kinds of places. So that includes procedures like the application of silver diamine fluoride, which can stop the progression of decay. Again, one drop of this liquid. They can take teeth like this that in many children, that small hole would soon become a bigger and bigger hole, and then all the bad consequences. In about 10 minutes, no drilling, no anesthesia, you have a restoration that can last as long as conventional restorations. So, 20 years ago, we did a demonstration of this concept all across California, very large, 15 site communities and about 50 different sites and, thousands of patients. And we were able to demonstrate that you could not only reach people that were not typically reached, you could emphasize prevention, lower costs, and keep the majority of people healthy on site. 85% of children and even the majority of adults with disabilities can have all the needed services they need by the hygienist in a community without needing to make a trip to a dental office. And this really does give an opportunity to emphasize the adoption of what I call mouth healthy habits, which is the things that people do every day that prevent disease from occurring. So a really big change in the way we think about dental disease. And then just to make one more point about this idea of adopting mouth healthy habits, again, I'm mostly talking about eating, brushing habits, not having too much sugar or not having sugar too frequently. I find it interesting. We just completed a literature search. We're going to be publishing this very soon about the, I think the too narrow focus. I think it's true across general healthcare systems as well. The real focus is often about giving people information. You tell people what to do, and then you get surprised when they don't do it. Well, Most people are not surprised because they realize that telling people what to do doesn't result in most people doing it. And the problem is that it's just not the right approach for most people. What we know, if you look at the psychology literature about how people actually adopt new habits, it's different than just telling them what to do. Of course, the messages and the information is an important beginning. But first of all, having messages delivered by trusted members of their own community, someone who's culturally congruent with them, are much more likely to be acted on. If I say something to someone, often the response is, "Well, that's very nice for you, but you don't really understand how my life works." Of course, they're not going to say that, but that's what they're thinking. But having someone who's a member of their own community, much more likely to be listened to. Of course, multiple people delivering the same message is helpful. But the real key, if you want to have someone change habits, you've got to start with small incremental behavior changes. It's just too much for someone to go from not doing something to doing it a lot. Most people are just not going to do that. So finding something they can do easily, with a very small change, and then having some way for ongoing reinforcement and coaching. Here's a small thing. Do you think you'd be able to do that? Yeah, that sounds okay. Can I talk to you next week and see how it's going? Sure, ongoing reinforcement, that kind of stuff. Dentists and hygienists cannot do that. And there's no ability to be able to call someone up every few days and see how you're doing with the, starting to brush a little bit and now starting to brush a little bit more. So it's really critical that we start to think about integrating oral health services in with community organizations for this reason, if no others. But of course, there's a lot of other reasons. Okay, so then the last sort of part here was this whole idea of community engaged systems. Just as a preview, what I'm about to get into in a minute. This is a photograph of a dental hygienist, RDHP hygienist, working with a young man. He's got the mask over his face because he didn't like the light in his eyes. But other than that, he's actually very cooperative. He's in his own home there. She's brought in portable equipment. This is someone who had all of his previous dental care done under anesthesia. The trajectory he was on, he was always going to have the care under anesthesia. Really, just by changing the venue to bring care into a more comfortable place, to be able to approach a little more slowly, he was actually fine, and he'll never have to go back to the hospital or have sedation or anesthesia again. So a couple of years ago, in Sacramento, there was a big study that was done about the use of anesthesia for dental care in that region. And it's interesting that their conclusions were the same conclusions we came to in 2008. So unfortunately, that meant things hadn't changed very much. Why were people not having care in a more regular manner, inadequate reimbursement, and that included dentists, anesthesiologists, hospitals, too much paperwork, too much uncompensated time, lack of awareness, all kinds of things. And this is not just California. This is true really across the country. So the recommendations from that report was, number one, expand operating room capacity for dental cases. And there's been a little bit of movement in that area. Actually, the California Dental Association managed to get a bill introduced. That would the bill is actually going to put about $50 million into building new surgical services. But I tell you, it's just a drop in the bucket, and we're never going to solve this issue by building more operating room capacity. So I'm really focused on recommendation number two, which is how do we support alternatives to general anesthesia? So the idea is we have these long wait lines where there's so many people waiting for anesthesia, the demand is far exceeding the supply. And if we could just do something that would not, and some people, that's the only way they're going to get care. But if we could take the people where, in my view, they're in those lines unnecessarily, then we could cut them out the line down. The people who actually need that level of service could get it much more timely manner without this horrible waiting. And most people could get care in a much more humane way, which would be it's healthier for them. They learn to be able to accept dental care. They could have it more frequently. So there's lots of reasons to want to move in that direction. So after looking at this issue, we came up with an idea, which was supporting these alternatives to anesthesia and sedation. And the benefits would be shorter lines, less wait time, saving lots of costs in many things, fewer adverse outcomes, pain and infection, better health. And this could actually influence state and national policy. So at the beginning, this was about 4 years ago, we started with a group of focus groups. The first one of them was with the behavior support specialists. And we asked them, these are behavior support specialists already working with populations of people with developmental disabilities, not around dental care, but around other issues, and ask them if you could work those people around dental care to try and get them to maybe with a slow introduction, how many of the people you're working with who are currently being told they need care under anesthesia could have care without anesthesia? And what they said was 80%. That they thought 80% of the people there were saying, I thought, boy, that's pretty high. I don't know if that's true, but I was guessing 50%. So it made me feel good about my 50% guess. We also asked a group of dentists similar questions. So, what are the barriers? And it's the same list of barriers. Again, we had this list in 2008, so the list is not anything new, but it's the fees are low and there's a lot of paperwork and they don't have enough training and takes a lot of more time and it throws off their schedules and then that's non-compensated time. And then some people need extensive care and people don't keep their appointments and they have trouble getting information, the health history, and they don't know who to contact about consent and, for all these reasons. So we started asking them a series of questions. Well, what if, a lot of what if questions, what if we were able to give you additional training about people with disabilities? And they said, yeah, that'd be nice, but it doesn't address the issues of fees and time and behavior and schedules and appointments. Okay, well, what if we were to give you a training about behavior support strategies? Yeah, that would be nice, but it wouldn't address fees and time and information and scheduling and appointments. Well, what if we were to give you some training about how to make sure you got all the health and other history information and consent information? Yeah, that would be somewhat helpful, but still doesn't address fees and behaviors and schedules. What if we were to help you with a targeted referral where the people referred to you had already been seen by a professional like a hygienist, already had some preliminary work done? Already when they came into your office, we'd know exactly, you'd know exactly what needed to be done. Maybe they already had all kinds of records you reviewed ahead of time. We really, a very warm handoff for you and your staff about what kind of behavior supports work for this person. That would be even more helpful. Still a few things it doesn't address. What if we would do all that? Plus, we could give you some, we could pay you for the additional time it might take for a few sort of get to know you visits to sort of start care slowly so you wouldn't feel the pressure to just get a lot of stuff done the first time the person's in. And then we finally got to, okay, that I would do that. Sign me up. So basis on the basis of those focus groups, we ended up designing a system which was this is the proposal, which was to bring care to where people are in familiar locations, to be able to use behavior, physical, psychological support, use all of the things I talked about a few minutes ago with the modern science and minimally invasive prevention, early intervention procedures, have something that was really the community care and the office care was very much linked together using a telehealth system, very targeted referrals where someone would only be referred after going a long ways in the community, and the person who got referred to would be very well trained and get a very warm handoff, and also being able to pay everyone in the system for traditionally non-covered services like desensitization and care management and education. So with that set of proposals, we got to work in terms of putting this together. We've now have a system. We've been using it now for close to a year. And the structure is we are working now primarily with the Alta California Regional Center and the Valley Mountain Regional Center. We've got some interest in working a little bit with some of the other regional centers in California. But the way the structure works is patients are referred to our program by the Regional Center Service Coordinator. We have what we call our community outreach team. They gather additional information, history information, billing information, contact information. The Regional Center is actually paying for work not covered by other sources of payments through the purchase of service funds. Regional centers are always been able to do that. Every regional center in California can do that. Most don't. And so it took some work, I think, to get everybody aligned that this was something they were allowed to do, they could do, it can make a big difference. And now we have several regional centers that are fully embracing that and using it. We still got further to go with many of the regional centers in California to actually be able to get them to be able to do something they're already allowed to do, but they're currently not doing. We're using a system, a software system, this company called Teledentics that ties everything together. We're actually got some funding. Now we're building an app, which is a decision support system. It helps to we got a contract from the regional center to do this, and it's going to be available for really all the regional centers in California probably next year. That when it helps to support in between visits where the caregivers can be asked to do something, they have a way of reporting back how it's going. The professionals are working with them, don't have to have all the actions and interactions in person. They can jump on a quick video call. It's all built into the system to help support people in adopting new behaviors and habits. So it's easy for the regional center service coordinators to register someone, collect information, and then be able to figure out what are the next steps for that person, put it into the app, and then be able to have a system where ongoing care and monitoring of what happens with the person. So with all of that stuff, we now have this system working. We have what we call our community outreach team. So CNU, COT is our California North State University Community Outreach Team. We have a dental hygienist and an assistant, and we also have a behavior support therapist who works with them. So the principles are a couple. Number one, we are starting the work with them in the most comfortable environment we can find. So for many people, it's actually their home. Sometimes it's we have some special schools for people with disabilities. We're doing some work there. Sometimes it might be another location, but we want to start in a place that's the most comfortable environment. We don't want the unfamiliarity of the environment to be a factor that makes it so we're going to be unsuccessful. So starting in a comfortable environment, very slowly building trust. The pace is completely set by the person's anxiety and trust level. So if the first visit, all you can do is smile at someone across the room, that's all you do. And maybe the next visit, they'll let you get a little closer. And for some people, it might take a couple of visits before they'll let you come up close to them. And maybe at some point, you're taking a quick look in their mouth. But the principle is at the end of every visit, you want every visit to end so that the person feels good about that. That was not a big deal. I could do that again. So it's a very slow desensitization process. We're working with a behavior support therapist. We have a meeting every week with our community outreach team that meets with a behavior support therapist and goes over how things are going and gets suggestions. We're using some sophisticated desensitization techniques and some reward systems, but I'd say it's primarily just being a slow introduction and going at the pace that works for the person. That's primarily what we're doing. So with the it says a simple patient-based approach, introducing everything gradually, a little time, they transform how patients think about dental care, and a strong collaboration with the regional center. So the goal is to desensitize people and keep them out of sedation or anesthesia. And for that really, as I said, in shortening the line, the people who actually need that level of service can be able to get to it much more quickly if we take the people that don't need the services out of the line. So I'll give you just a two quick case reports, photograph with permission of the family. This young man is 11 years old. He's got autism, moderate to severe cognitive impairment, nonverbal, fairly resistant to any kind of healthcare services. He's been told any kind of care. He's never had care, any kind of dental care before without sedation or anesthesia. He's very afraid of dentists and office settings and hospital settings and medical settings. Anybody who's near him with scrubs or gloves or goggles, that's they're not going to be able to do anything for him. So in a quick sort of run through of the number of visits with him, the first visit was just really talking to his mother. They did manage to get a quick look in his mouth with a mirror, and then suggested that the mother sort of practice with him in between visits to put on a mask and wear some gloves and maybe do a little bit of brushing and flossing. At the second visit, he actually sat down between them and started to brush the teeth of a puppet they had. So a very sort of soft transfer from the puppet brushing to be able to work in his own mouth. The third visit, they actually brushed his teeth. They have a portable dental chair, which they introduced. Started the loop is one of these things that has a head-mounted light to brush his teeth. By the fourth visit, they were using the portal X-ray, taking X-rays. He sat still for some answer. This was the first time he'd had X-rays in his entire life. By the fourth visit, a fifth visit, polished his teeth, got him used to some of the sounds and vibrations while laying in the chair. Sixth visit, completed cleaning his teeth and an application of fluoride varnish, and then by the seventh visit, he was able to come into our dental clinic and sit in a dental clinic in a regular chair. And now at this point, he's had everything he needs to have done, and he's actually scheduled on a recall for to be able to see him again in 3 months. Now, and compare that to having all his life going into the hospital and having care under anesthesia. And this is his mother's response to all that. He'd only been ever seen for sedation and anesthesia. He couldn't even walk into a medical setting without running away at the sight of masks and gloves. Through this program, Jamie and Mira, that's our team, we're able to gently guide him through X-rays, cleanings, instructions in a way that completely transformed his confidence. He walks into the clinic now, enjoys his appointments, and is only given him dental care. It's actually not only given him dental care, it's actually changed his life. So it's changed the way he goes to medical appointments and other things now. So that was one patient. I'm just going to do one more, and then we'll sort of wrap things up here. So a second patient was this one's a little bit older, 33-year-old, intellectual disabilities, autism. Level of condition is severely impaired, nonverbal, moderate to severe resistance. Again, all the dental care he's ever had has been under anesthesia. And appointment number one in his in his house. They noted he had just heavy plaque and buildup, and his gums were very inflamed. He was having no home care. They realized he was highly motivated by food, and he was been given lots of sugary food. On his second appointment, they were actually able to do some video instructions for him. They actually were able to take some X-rays by the second appointment. Third appointment, they were hand scaling his teeth. They used a technique where they were counting to 20. So he'd come and sit in the chair. They would count out loud to 20. When he knew that when he got to 20, he was able to take a break. So he was able to sit down, walk around, and come back and sit back in the chair. Fourth appointment, having some topical anesthetic gel and cleaning his teeth and introducing the vibrating teeth cleaning instrument they call the Cavitron. And then advancing to using some topical gel, completely hand scaling him. And then he ended up coming as his first appointment ever into our dental clinic, getting used to the chair and was able to have complete deep scaling of all of his teeth in the dental clinic. And now he's actually tolerating local anesthetic injections for continued deep cleanings. He's more comfortable. They actually have a reward system that they're using with, I hope those are sugar-free cookies. The team has produced these slides for me. And this is someone, again, that, the conclusion of our team working with him with the support of the behaviorists is, when patients are met with patience, consistency, individualized support, they're finding even the most challenging people can have dental care barriers overcome, and their ability to successfully have treatment without fear, and it improves their oral health and also enhances their life. And I want to say that when we first started doing this, you heard me say earlier, my guess was that we could take maybe 50% of the people who were told they needed dental care anesthesia and have them not have it. So far in our program, it's 100%. These are all people that were told the only way they're ever going to get dental care is under anesthesia sedation. And right now, all of the people we've worked with so far have been able to get what they needed to have done without anesthesia. One thing that's been very interesting that is because of this work, it started to attract attention around the state. And this is a call to action from the ARC of California. They got understanding about this, what we were doing a couple of years ago, got in contact with me, and they took the initiative to introduce a bill, AB 341. Assemblymember Rambula was the author for the bill. This bill was introduced by them into the legislature. And what's happened with it is that in 2025, the bill was introduced. It passed through the assembly in 2025, passed the Senate later that year, and was signed by the governor in last year in October. So, when this bill first started, boy, I thought, this could be a lot of money. People don't really understand. There's no way this is going to pass. So I was thrilled that the bill actually did pass. This is the ARC website about the announcement that the bill passed. Governor Newsom signs landmark dental care bill AB 341 into legislation. And the purpose of the bill is to engage all 21 regional centers in adopting the system that we've come up with, enlist dental offices to build local teams, design continued operation systems, and have a statewide advisory committee and learning committee to be able to bring this all forward. So the bill is passed. It's in the hands of the Department of Developmental Services now. They have until early next year to be able to develop a contract and develop what is being called the Technical Assistance Center to be able to put this all together and provide the training. So we're super excited about the fact we're able to start down this road, and it's now got legislation, and there's going to be funding to spread this idea. I realize that I've been talking kind of fast in the interest of time, and I wanted to try and get a lot of stuff covered here. And I certainly haven't talked about everything related to oral health for people with developmental disabilities, but I think this is one of the most important things that's going on right now is this idea, this really horrible thing of people who actually really don't need it, having being told they need dental care under anesthesia and sedation. And we've been way too reliant on a system that really doesn't work for people. And by now, the ability, it's both the funding system we worked out, the training, the collaboration with the regional center, the collaboration with behavior support specialists, we've been able, I think, to fundamentally transform how we think about dental care for some people who have difficulty getting in a normal environment. And I see this really continuing to spread because there's so many reasons why this is so much better for people, including the costs, including the risk and downsides of anesthesia, including the fact that when you have anesthesia, you don't learn anything about dental care being okay. So that keeps on being repeated. And for all those reasons, we're excited about the fact that we've been able to get this. As I said, it's working actually much better than I thought it would. I always thought that this was important. It would make a big difference, but the results have really been spectacular. And you know, I thank our team, who's we have a great team, but it's not just our team. We're planning with the help of the experience that we have now, and the electronic support system we're building through the funding from the regional center. The hope is that we will take that AB 341 and be able to spread this methodology to all the regional centers in California, and hopefully, you know, in the next number of years, be able to drastically cut down the number of people who are being told they need dental care under sedation and anesthesia. So I will stop with the slides now and be happy to talk this over and answer any questions people have.
Well, there's a lot of enthusiasm about
Okay.
this, and I want to thank you. I think a theme for the day is we're seeing examples of things that nobody thought were possible. I remember when I started 20 years ago working in group homes, I'm embarrassed to say that I thought that having poor dentition and bad breath was a part of having a developmental disability, because I'd never met anybody in my practice who didn't have that. And then the regional center and your work started teaching the group homes and teaching us how to do a better job, and now that's no longer the case. So this is enormously powerful work that I've seen progress over the course of my career, and you've really influenced me both as a clinician and a parent. Again, thank you. Lots of interest in the Q&A, so let me get to those.
Okay, sure.
How should we approach conversations with caregivers who feel the individual should be sedated for any type of dental or RDHDP-HAP interaction? The desensitization clinics at the regional centers have helped, but sedation continues to be a common request for any and all needs.
A couple of things to say about that. You know, I think that I think we have to recognize that there is a some number of people, caregivers, who would actually prefer that their client have it under anesthesia because it's easier for them. It's like one stop, you take them to the hospital, you drop them off, you pick them up later, and it's all done. I think that's the case. That is certainly true for some people. But I think even people who realize it's more convenient for them probably do on some level realize it's not good. It's not the best thing for the people they're caring for. And I think that the people who would prefer that just out of their own convenience, it's really becoming the minority. At least the people we have been working with, overwhelmingly, they do realize that it's much better for the people they're serving. And it's not just that it's better because of the fact that you get the dental care done in a sooner way. People learn to have care, but there are all kinds of other consequences from not having regular dental care. You just can't take someone into the hospital often enough to make up for having them not being involved in a dental care system in between. So people develop much worse dental disease if they're only treated in the hospital. And as everyone, I think, on this conference knows, having dental disease has all kinds of manifestations, from people not eating well to developing systemic infections, all kinds of immune consequences that affect the rest of the body. So there's lots of reasons why it's important. Obviously, talking with any individual caregiver, there's conversations you need to have and help them understand why this is both better for their client and actually why it's better for them. You know, I think that everybody, human nature, people much respond much better when they can understand why something's better for them personally. We all care about ourselves first, and then our family second, and then our community next. So if you can help people understand why this is better for them, they actually tend to understand it and then want to be able to see this better system take place. And I think there was a second part of the question, which I've now forgotten. Chris, was there a second part?
I think you've covered it.
Okay. All right. Very good.
There's a lot of interest in how do you access this type of care? How do you make a referral? Do we just have to wait until we can just send it back to the regional center, or are there ways for people to access this care who aren't eligible for regional center services? Because this isn't the only population who could benefit from this.
Okay, yeah. So, well, first of all, I just want to say something. You said something a few minutes ago about, and I think was in the question, was that some of the regional centers have desensitization clinics, which I think is great that they're doing that. But you know what, I know a lot of people in a lot of regional centers, and we talked to a lot of people who are doing this kind of stuff. There's a number of regional centers that are doing it in a physical building where they have maybe behavior support therapists and the person comes in the building, that can be beneficial, but it's really too much for some people. That I think the principle I said before is if you're going to be successful, you've got to start in the very most comfortable environment with someone. And there's some people, you walk through the door of a strange building and there's a dental chair there, it's just too much. You're not going to really make progress. So I think for the regional centers that are doing it that way, good for them. They should continue doing it. But I hope that at some point they can actually extend that and start in a place that's more comfortable, only bring someone into the physical building with a chair after they've had some desensitization. In terms of the second part of the question, how do other people that are not in the regional centers we're currently working with do that? Well, I know there's a number of regional centers because I've talked to people. This is not the first time we've talked about this. A lot of people are aware of it. There are some regional centers that are making steps in this direction. I think there's a couple of things that are going to have to be addressed going forward. One is what I mentioned already. Many regional centers are not using this purchase of service to the extent that it could be. They do it a little bit, or they limit, or they can only do it for 3 visits, or some are not using it at all. So, first of all, the providers who are doing this, both the behaviorists and the dental providers, have to be able to do things at a pace that's appropriate for the person. As soon as you start to limit, you can only have 3 visits, then already you're very soon into doing something that's too much for the person at the time, and then it's not going to work out very well. So the whole idea, and that's part of what AB 341 would hope to do, is to use the resources to be able to help all the regional centers in the state understand how they can use this prerogative they already have, but most are not using it. So I think that's going to have to be addressed, the payment mechanism. And then I think part of the question was, can somebody make a referral to somebody right now? Well, no, I guess the answer is no. If you're not in a place where a regional center is already doing this, I think you're going to have to wait until the regional center in your area actually gets the training or begins to adopt this kind of system. There are some that are doing some halfway measures, and I think that's great that you can work with them. But I don't think there's any places that are doing this fully the way we are right now. And but hopefully that won't be too long. That's what we're looking forward to, is that this will become widespread across the state before too long.
Wonderful. I know there is a registry of people who have the RDHAP
Yes,
credential,
right.
and you can contract with them privately. A lot of them are
Right.
not contracted with regional center or are not contracted with Medi-Cal, but you can, if you have a way to pay for it, then
Yeah.
they are accessible.
I think that's exactly right. I think the key to what you just said is if you have a way to pay for it. So, which is true for some people, but not true for many. So, yeah.
And I'm wondering too whether major to make this easier for people, other places where people are comfortable are, their day services
Yes, right,
or
exactly.
schools or,
Yes.
maybe there's other places we could do this as well.
Actually, there's been history now in Stockton. There's a school for almost 15 years, the school for people, kids with developmental disabilities. They've been doing this, and we have one now in Sacramento, same thing. So yeah, it doesn't have to be the home, but it has to be a comfortable environment where people don't have to be nervous about the environment at the beginning. They just can concentrate on adopting some small new thing and then move on to the next thing.
Yeah, I mean, as parents, having had so many bad experiences going to the dentist and just being, I can't do this again.
Yeah, right.
If you do it in a school or in the developmental services, then you can get some support from their aid, so you don't have to do it yourself.
Right.
Also, let's see, how do we as pediatricians refer? Okay, so referral, more lots of questions about referrals. Is a dentist refusing to see someone based off their disability considered discrimination?
You can make the case for that, and actually, there have been some dentists. It's not just dentists, but there have been medical providers who have been sued under the Americans with Disabilities Act because of refusing to see someone. But it gets a little bit ambiguous when you get to a situation where maybe they do agree to see an appointment. They say your needs or your just beyond what I can do. That's a little harder to be able to make a case that it's a discrimination, because there's no healthcare provider who's expected to be able to see everybody with every kind of condition. So that gets to be a bit of a gray area.
Thank you. A clinical question is putting a pea-sized amount of baking soda when brushing teeth still best practice?
Not particularly. So
Okay.
I think the best practice is depending on the age of the person. So for young children, there are guidelines about, depending on their age, how much fluoride toothpaste is what you should be using.
Mm-hmm.
Baking soda, It's a little bit more abrasive. It doesn't. It has some advantages in terms of buffering saliva, but really, it's not particularly necessary or considered necessarily a best practice.
Okay. So it sounds so we're coming up on time. Maybe you might be able to answer some of the questions that have come up in writing
Absolutely, yes.
backstage, but
Be ha happy to.
the pretty smiles that you have helped create have so are have health impacts, but they also have a lot of social impacts because it makes people more engaging when they have good dental hygiene. So it improves so many different aspects of people's lives, and this was very well deserved. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at UCTV.tv.